Remember Congressman Dennis Kucinich, the peace candidate, who was redistricted out of Congress by our friends the Democrats? How many of us voted for him? Well, he came to Cambridge and spoke at the Harvard Kennedy School last Friday night, and he talked about his experience, and he talked about the present administration, and he talked about Russia, and we want you to hear it. So here is Dennis Kucinich.
Good afternoon, good evening. I'm grateful for the Progressive Organization at the Harvard Kennedy School for making this moment possible for all of us. And I'm particularly grateful for the presence of some of you I've met over the last two decades of my involvement in national politics. I first ran for Congress on an issue that related to an intense international issue, the war in Vietnam. And it was my first congressional bid. I won the primary in the Cleveland area, the Cleveland suburban constituency. And in the general election, the Republicans tied me, my campaign, to McGovern, who I ran with and who I campaigned with. McGovern lost the district that I ran in by a 3-to-1 margin. I lost by 1%. I ran an anti-war campaign in a middle-class to working-class district, which had a Republican congressman for 16 years. And it included suburbs like Parma, Ohio, which is rather famous as a place where so-called Reagan Democrats proliferated. And Parma also had a strong showing for Trump in this past election. But what I found through my early involvement, and this was my first congressional race, was that if you went door to door and talked to people personally, that you might be able to shift their positions on some pretty important issues if you bring it down to a level that people really get. In the case of the Vietnam War, there were kids from these communities who were getting killed or were injured. The cost of the war was staggering. The impact on the people in Vietnam, later on in Cambodia and Laos, was extraordinary. And so I have here from my first congressional campaign a copy of the first leaflet that I dropped in 1972. My wife will attest that I don't throw away anything. Kucinich says, end the war. President Nixon now admits his policy of de-escalation in Vietnam has failed. The choice is to re-escalate or get out, the president has stated. Why make the same mistake again? So this was my first campaign, and I actually ran for Congress 5 times before I got elected, over a period of 25 years. And each time I found that there was some international policy issue that drew me to a campaign. And unfortunately, for several attempts, it had to do with Vietnam. Once I was elected to the House in 1996, I saw early on in some of the discussions how easy it was for members of Congress to get drawn into discussions over war. Notably, when we were at war, we were promoting a war against Serbia. The people in Serbia wanted to dump their leader. There's just no question about it. There was hundreds of thousands of people massing in Belgrade trying to overthrow Milosevic. And so, but what the United States did at that point was to bomb Belgrade and ended up causing people to close ranks behind Milosevic. And I was instrumental in my second term in Congress in helping to defeat Senate Joint Resolution 21, which would have enabled the Congress to authorize then President Clinton's attack on Serbia, and would have enabled the president to be able to continue the war there. One of the things that I did in Congress early on was to raise the question of Congress's ultimate responsibility on matters of war and peace. Now we know from reading many different books that Congress's prerogative, indeed its responsibility and duty, had been usurped by a series of presidents. Indeed, there were books about Nixon called The Imperial Presidency and like that would assert how presidents just grabbed the power. But when you go back to the founders, it was very clear where, you know, George Washington said in 1793, the Constitution vests the power of declaring war in Congress. Similar remarks were made by James Madison, by Thomas Jefferson, and Alexander Hamilton, who actually dissected the war power that was that we modeled the Constitution so that, as in Britain, the king could basically drag a country into war. We made it possible that couldn't happen, so that it was Congress that would have to have the authority. I raised these issues repeatedly in Congress through a series of escalating tensions where the United States ultimately went to war and went to federal court to raise the issue about Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, which gave Congress the war-making power. Well, what was interesting, in a case of Campbell versus Clinton, the federal court held that essentially this war-making power will belong to Congress. Congress's ultimate authority was with the budget. If Congress appropriated funds for a war, the war kept going. If it cut off the funds, the war ended. Now, when we look at what's happening right now in international relations, the new president has stated an interest in creating safe zones in Syria. Those safe zones would, per force, be a declaration of war if the United States goes in and tries to carve out an area, period. The truth is that ISIS is already on the run in much of Syria. And no thanks to the U.S., which unfortunately, with Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey, and other nations, has helped to keep the war going in some insane attempt to assist in supplanting a government in Damascus with a caliphate. And so Congress is going to have to become involved in that question. Congress is going to have to become involved in the question of whether we are going to, in effect, re-escalate in Afghanistan, because there was discussion with respect to that. Congress is going to have to become involved in the question as to how much more deeper the United States, after already having declared the war in Iraq is over, going to go back in, as we see the escalation in Mosul going on. So while a lot is said about the president's profile and his use of power, we have a tripartite government, and the powers are divided, and they're co-equal, that the legislative branch has a grave responsibility here to stand up for the Constitution. And the courts have already shown a willingness on other issues to intervene if this administration, which is obviously totally lacking in a political experience and in legislative and legal experience, if they go off the rails. So it comes back to Congress. What are we going to do? Now, one of the things that I'm deeply concerned about that I see as someone who has worked throughout my career in trying to build friendly relations with Russia, I'm very concerned in what I see coming from the left as a bitter attack on Russia, which is really creating preconditions for another Cold War. It's very dangerous. Russia, you know, I first went to Russia in 1991 and have made a dozen trips since then and have met with people at all levels of society, members of the Russian Academy of Sciences, who took me to where the first nuclear bomb was developed in a secret city. When I flew in for that meeting and the plane broke through the clouds on the approach to Sheremetyevo Airport, and I looked at these little picket fences out in the countryside, the circumference which enclosed the dachas, the humanity of the people just came to me very quickly. And I rode public transportation in the Moscow area. And I saw, this was in the 90s, how people would, you get on a bus anywhere and give your fare to the person next to you, and they'd pass it up hand to hand along to the front fare box. And there, you know, and I got a chance to get to know the people of Russia and to get to study their history and find out in some ways how much we had in common, but they had some things in their experience that we didn't have. They lost 30 million people in World War II. They understand war in a way that we understand it through the losses that we had during World War II, but the, you know, except for the attack on Pearl Harbor, which was devastating, the losses that the Russian people had were extraordinary. And if you go from the airport into Moscow, and there's three big iron X's that mark the place along the highway. They mark the place where the Russian army stopped the German advance into Moscow. And Moscow and the United States cooperated to bring an end to that war. But then there was a flip. And off that flip was the fact that we did not want Russia to be in competition with the United States. And so while they had some missile technology they developed, we then jumped into the development of a whole new series of armaments that led to a Cold War. And, you know, when I was growing up in Cleveland, Ohio, I remember well the duck and cover drills, which, you know, we can remember with a certain amount of jocularity, but the truth of the matter is, in the 50s, there were serious discussions about whether or not Russia was going to launch an attack on the United States, and whether or not the United States was going to attack Russia came to a culmination in the Cuban Missile Crisis. We went through the period of Cold War continuing through the 60s, through the 70s. And then later on, when Gorbachev came in, changes in Russia, a period of glasnost, and it looked like the United States had finally been able to reached some agreement, the ABM Treaty, notably, which Bush then canceled, put us unilaterally, took us back. But still, there was work being done, parliamentary meetings that were going on all the time, and it looked like we were going to be able to reach a kind of a rapprochement with Russia. The media played a role in that. Ted Koppel's Nightline famously had conversations going between the people of Russia and the people of the United States, brought them together for the first time so they could see each other and talk to each other and to learn again how much we had in common. So where are we today? Today we're at the start of a new Cold War again with Russia. And I just on the way over, on a plane ride over here, I read the Director of National Intelligence report on so-called Russia interference in the election. And frankly, it's pretty sketchy. And what it centers on more than anything is the effect of RT, the television station, on the projected effect of RT on U.S. audiences as interfering with our political process. I don't like the way that the intelligence agencies have played this. And I don't like the way the outgoing president created a shift to create a reinvention of sanctions to go after Russia for supposedly interfering in an election. Frankly, the case hasn't been made. It has not been made. Not just saying it over and over and over doesn't make it so. And it was said over and over and over to try to make it appear that this is what happened, that Russia somehow interfered with the election. But even Clapper, who testified to Congress, had to admit that there was no evidence that Russia meddled in any way with the election itself. And as far as any of the hacking at the DNC, the case is still open about that. But we're at a point right now where some people in the intelligence community are trying to reignite a Cold War using the fact that an administration or some of its appointees had contact with Russia, as though just the contact was taboo, verboten. What's that about? This is not a new thing, and I want to share with you some stories about this. I was instrumental in forming a Russia-Duma joint parliamentary caucus in the Congress. It was a bipartisan caucus. And I put together a group of Democrats and Republicans who were interested in building relationships with Russia. And we had a couple meetings that, you know, we ended up going into a very tough election season, and it didn't get that far, but it was a culmination of a lot of contact that had been made by many of us with members of the Duma, both through meetings in the United States and meetings in Moscow. And so there'd been frequent contact. And in the course of that, I had people coming to my office to talk about what would be the agenda and things like that. And as soon as I left Congress, I was contacted by the FBI, who wanted to know, who do they meet with in my office from Russia? Who do they meet with? And what did we talk about? Well, I had to inform them of this little thing about the speech and debate clause in the Constitution, which they were not familiar with, that said that a member of Congress shall not be questioned on any matter relating to his legislative responsibilities, period, by anyone, even the FBI. But they were so interested. I was at a reception in Nice, France, that for whatever reason, I ended up sitting next to a person, and this was about 3 years ago. It'll be 3 years this year. I ended up sitting next to a person who had just come from a meeting in the White House and a meeting at the State Department over energy policies. He happened to be the head of Total Oil Company in France, the third largest oil company in Europe. And his name was Christoph. When I was first met him, he had a handlebar mustache. I thought he was the person that sets up this big art in the fields, or just an artist, because he looked like an artist. But it turns out he was in a different kind of art, the art of energy. And he immediately, understanding my involvement in America, he immediately shared with me his experience at the White House and at the State Department, where he was told in so many words and verbatim from the State Department, well, you have to support us in our effort to exclude Russia. And then he was told specifically, we have to kill the Russians. Those are the words that were used. And this man, who, was by no means a rookie in international affairs, and as the head of an oil company, had contacts all over the world, his eyes started to tear, and he asked, what kind of people are they? They talk so easily about killing others. What do they mean? And so the old saw about, would some power God give us to see ourselves as others see us, came home in that meeting, because I met someone who was a high-level businessman and diplomat who worked back and forth between Paris and Russia, meeting with Medvedev mainly on international energy policy, and he was basically being told by the United States what direction he had to take. This man, Christoph, 2 months after this meeting that I had with him, where it was a dinner meeting and we spent a couple hours talking, his plane was taking off at an airport outside of Moscow after he met with Medvedev. And it was early autumn, and there was no snow, but a snowplow backed up into the runway, and his plane hit it, and he was killed. This U.S. involvement and our relationship with Russia are really important for many reasons. But another reason is the amount of nuclear weapons that are out there. Now, in the closing days of the Obama administration agreed to $1 trillion refurbishment of our nuclear infrastructure. How many of you are aware of that, by the way? And there are studies. There's a piece today by Chuck Spinney and Pierre Fry. They published a piece. They're two people who were longtime defense analysts. They published a piece saying that this recommitment to nuclear escalation puts the United States on a path to spend not one but $3 trillion based on the usual cost overruns that occur. And that we're doing this, and the elites in Russia who are looking at this are becoming very nervous about the United States, which put up a so-called missile defense in Eastern Europe. And the old saying about a shield is first a shield and then the sword. And so there is growing concern in Russia about what the U.S. intentions are, as there is growing concern in Russia when the U.S. reneged on its promise not to promote NATO to Russia's borders, which NATO, which started off as a defensive organization dealing with, by definition, the North Atlantic, suddenly discovers the North Atlantic on the border of Afghanistan or someplace. Geographically impaired, yes, but politically toxic. And we're now looking at NATO on the Russian border at long-standing policy by neoconservatives and neoliberals to encircle Russia, added to a planned U.S. military buildup, added to this nuclear refurbishment of the nuclear infrastructure, added to the rhetoric, which is coming out of some unseemly political circles in Washington, and we have a witch's brew for a whole new Cold War. And none of it is necessary. So the Trump administration, which has unfortunately committed itself to this to continuation of the plan that the Obama administration had with respect to building up nuclear arms, which has also considered committed itself to a military buildup, which is does not bode well for what might happen in Iraq, Afghanistan, perhaps Syria, and which puts us in a position where we're going to have to rely on Congress to enforce its constitutional role, something that Congress has not wanted to do. Now, one of the first meetings I was at as a member of Congress, I was on the Government Oversight Committee, a committee that eventually I became a chairman of a subcommittee on. But on the full committee, Government Oversight invites in people to testify to various issues about their management of taxpayers' dollars. There was the Pentagon had come in for a report from the Inspector General that declared, this was in 1997, 20 years ago, that the Pentagon could not account for over $1 trillion in expenditures. They couldn't reconcile their accounts. Today it's in multiple trillions. They've never passed an audit. The American people end up being suckers for this entire military-industrial complex, which now it's military-industrial intelligence and congressional complex. Because what happens is all of these defense plans are put, or war plans, are put into operation through putting contracts into all the congressional districts. And members have individuals who come to their office and lobby them, saying, we have jobs in our district that are on the line. You have to support this military budget. Now, you're looking at probably one of the few people in Congress in the 16 years that I spent in Congress who about 99% of the time, I'd say 100, but, you know, maybe there was one vote, but 99% of the time I voted against every single appropriation for war, for the military, because I knew it was a waste of money. I knew this was a scam. General Smedley Butler famously quoted many years ago, war is a racket. He was 100% right. Well, we have an obligation to defend our country. We also have an obligation to be smart and not to be played. I knew back in 2002 I knew right after 9/11, if you were to go to the internet and you see the speech that I made right after 9/11, I warned about using that as a means of going to war with the world. Later on, when it was clear that Bush was going after Iraq, I organized 125 Democrats and led the effort against the Iraq war because I saw it was a lie. I did an analysis. You could Google it at Kucinich, October 2nd, 2002, Iraq analysis. You'll see how it was so easy to understand that the case wasn't there. All you had to do was have your eyes open and not be craven or looking for some kind of a political support from somebody in the defense industry. Those forces are out there, and they're very active, and they have enormous influence on members of Congress. And we've been driven into wars based on lies. We were driven into a war based on lies in Iraq. We're driven into a war based on lies in Libya. And we're driven into a war based on total disinformation with respect to Syria. We have people in the northern part of Syria right now, U.S. advisors, that's the camel's nose under the tent, But we're advising certain people. It's hard to say who we're advising because of the various characters we've associated ourselves with in that conflict. But I bring this all up because the Trump administration and Trump's inaugural speech, and again today in his speech to the Conservative Political Action Committee, he has said that the United States has wasted a lot of money on these wars. That we could have spent that money on rebuilding America. Now, I would hope that observation on his part would mean that he's not inclined to do what others have done in both parties, and that is to take us into wars that will similarly deprive the United States of the ability to meet the needs of the people. But this effort to try to force the new administration into a conflict with Russia is a dangerous thing. And while we have the right to challenge, and must challenge, this administration on a whole range of policies, we have to be very careful that we don't align ourselves with interests who do not have the interests of the American people at heart, but instead are part of some kind of a deep state, a permanent behind-the-scenes government that wants to maintain control over U.S. policy, no matter who's in the White House, no matter who's in power. And that's one of my concerns. I wrote a piece about this that is on Newsweek's website. And I use this example, which is worth remembering. When we sit here as, you know, we all have our own political choices. I'm not going to assume who anybody voted for, but I'll tell you this. That in the closing months of the Obama administration, he sent John Kerry to meet with Lavrov in Paris, and they hammered out an agreement to end the war in Syria. And when they came to the agreement, principal elements of the agreement involved cooperation between the United States and Russia. It involved sharing intelligence information. It involved military cooperation in Syria. The Department of Defense and the CIA, unnamed people, but nevertheless prominently objected, publicly objected, to this agreement. 5 days after the agreement was reached, a military strike, U.S. Airstrike, on a Syrian army airbase killed about 100 soldiers, broke the agreement open, killed the agreement. Then Russia came up with an agreement with Turkey to try to limit the conflict. But this was done openly by the Defense Department in cooperation with the CIA. What President Obama should have done was fired both the Secretary of Defense and the head of the CIA right on the spot, as he should have fired the head of the FBI for interfering in the election with the announcement of a second investigation of Hillary Clinton. Should have been done. Should have been automatic. But instead, what's happened, though, is that this group that's honeycombed into the national security structure gained even more power. And then they target Flynn, who's an intel guy himself. He was head of defense intelligence. And imply that his phone calls violated law. He was an appointee in a transitional administration. And what the hell were they doing tapping his phones anyway? As if, as if any American phone is free from listening. And so this was used as an attempt to drive a wedge between the American people and their government to suggest that it's being run through Moscow. You know, when people would ask me about what is this thing about Russia interfering in the elections, and I, said half jokingly, well, if Russia had in fact been involved in the election on behalf of a candidate, maybe they would have given us some better candidates. The point is that we have to be really careful that we're not getting played here. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. I like to say I had 4 siblings who went to Harvard. Harvard Elementary School, that is. And I grew up in the neighborhoods of Cleveland. And I'm basically a Midwesterner. What you see is what you get. But I'm not afraid of asking questions. I don't consider myself a genius, but I'm really someone who's got to prove something to me. Don't just try to roll me or snowball me into thinking that I, you know, that I've got to go along with this because in order to be a good American, whatever that means. I'm concerned we're losing our country to war based on lies, to increased militarism, to this military industrial intelligence congressional combine, that the America that all of us grew up in is increasingly becoming distant and estranged from us by fear and by the attempt to get us to agree to more wars as a means of helping people make a lot of money. It's a racket. So where the new administration goes is going to depend not just on them, but on Congress. And we'll see if Congress is ready to stand up for the American people. One final note. The Democrats took back control of Congress in 2006 on a promise to end the war. How do I know that? I was the one who propelled the anti-war movement inside the Congress for several years, raised hell all over the country, and finally the war became an issue in 2006. We took back the House of Representatives, famously, and the next meeting, when we came to organize the Democratic caucus, the Democratic leader said, we're going to keep funding the war. I was horrified and really walked out of the room with an intention that I'd have to run for president again, if only to keep the war issue alive, knowing that, you know, that the odds were long. But the point is that this penchant for war is a bipartisan problem in the country. It's not like one party has achieved a level of honesty and purity with respect to our foreign policy. I thank you very much for this opportunity to share some of these thoughts with you in hopes that it will engender a discussion, and I'm looking forward to any questions that you have about anything I talked about, and there's plenty I didn't talk about. During my time in the House of Representatives, I gave over 600 speeches on Iraq. 600. And ran many resolutions in trying to get out. I gave hundreds of speeches trying to urge diplomacy with and avoiding war with Iran. Because some of you may not remember, but you know, it wasn't too long ago that the United States was actually talking about nuclear strikes with nuclear bunker busters on places like Natanz and Isfahan. And you know, I was very concerned that that would set off a world conflagration. This world that we have, that we enjoy, that we love, the connections that we have, the families, the loved ones, the things that we love about life, none of it's guaranteed to us. It's not guaranteed to us. And in a way, our involvement in politics, and maybe this is one thing that Trump's election will do, our involvement in politics is absolutely urgent. Not just to protect the interests of our communities, but to save the world. Because the world's at risk again. But it's not just because of one person. It's because there are many people that whose names we'll never know, whose faces we'll never see, who are dedicated to try to continue to stir things up, put us on the edge of conflict, so they can cash in. Thank you. Let's go to questions.